From WAMC in Albany, this is the Legislative Gazette, a weekly magazine about New York State government and politics. Your host is David Gastina, with political commentary by Dr. Alan Shartok, political scientist and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. Statewide distribution for the Legislative Gazette is made possible by New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.
Coming up this week, the legislature has the week off, but an unusual amount of protests and arrests are already part of this year's legislative session. Our political observer Alan Shartok shares his thoughts on New York U.S. Senator Kirsten Gillibrand saying Governor Cuomo would be a great candidate to run against Donald Trump in 2020. And New York State ranks fourth in the nation for the number of active hate groups. Those stories and more on the Legislative Gazette. The state legislature is off this week, but the session so far has featured an unusual amount of protests and arrests, and more actions are expected when lawmakers return. We get more from the Legislative Gazette's Karen DeWitt.
Twice already in the first few weeks of the 2017 legislative session, protesters have been arrested at the state capitol. Eight people committed civil disobedience in late January. They were demonstrating against Governor Cuomo's veto of a bill that would have provided funding for legal services for indigent New Yorkers. In early February, four people were arrested after they refused to leave a sit-in outside the governor's office. And the legislative budget hearings, normally somnolent events, have been punctuated by Occupy-style protesters interrupting the proceedings. The protests are in contrast to the large staged rallies in recent years organized by, among others, union leaders and charter schools and featuring elected officials. This year's events are much smaller, involving no more than 100 people. They represent, and in some cases are made up of, people who are generally marginalized in society. Vocal New York, the group behind some of the protests, was formed in the 1980s to advocate for people living with AIDS and HIV. On the day of the January 31st protest, the group's Jeremy Sanders explained that they would like Governor Cuomo, a more moderate Democrat, to push harder for issues, including an expanded millionaire's tax and the money for legal services.
We don't want to be harsh on the governor.
He says Cuomo backs keeping an income tax surcharge on all New Yorkers who earn more than $1 million, which is set to expire later this year. But the group and some other Democrats want more higher income tax brackets for people making more than $5 million and over $10 million, up to $100 million a year. They say it could pay for the legal services, help house the homeless, and fund better education and end inequities in public schools.
The governor has given soaring rhetoric about his progressive goals and his aspirations, and often he has not lived up to them. Behind closed doors, many of us know that he has opposed progressive policy changes that he has later adopted, often watering them down.
Cuomo is pushing for an alternative plan to fund legal services, but he said recently that too many taxes would cause an exodus of rich people from the state.
The fear is that you could raise taxes so high that people leave the state. And I do believe there's a tipping point.
And Cuomo's spokesman has said the groups are focusing on the wrong target and are letting their performance art override the facts. Sanders, speaking by phone this week, says there's a much larger context for the demonstrations. He says the group has stepped up its actions since the presidential elections. He says it's not just the win by President Donald Trump, which he fears will bring cuts to health care, but also the loss of Hillary Clinton, and with it, an end to the Clintons' brand of Democratic politics.
Clintonian Democrats, Big D Democrats, have long told us we just need to go slower. We need to accept that we can't win all of these demands. And to us, Cuomo represents a Clintonian-style Democrat who tells us that we need to be fiscally conservative at the expense of the needs that that our state has, both low-income people, working-class people, middle-class people.
More actions and perhaps arrests are expected at the Capitol in March as the April 1 budget deadline draws near. In Albany, I'm Karen DeWitt.
Joining us now, Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Chartok. Well, Alan, this week, as our Karen DeWitt has just reported, the legislature is off, but the session so far featuring an unusual amount of protests and arrests, and more actions are expected when lawmakers return. We've also seen the issue of the travel ban rearing its head, as well as immigration issues, and all of this, certainly the relationship between the Trump administration nationally in the state of New York.
Well, that's right. Donald Trump, of course, is a New Yorker, born and bred. Hasn't been back to New York because they think the minute he steps back, there's going to be a huge protest. And as we have learned these days, it at the airports and other places, it doesn't take 2 months of planning. It just takes the word is out and people show up. So Melania Trump has stayed in New York during the week with their son, but he's been going to Mar-a-Lago in Florida all winter thus far at tremendous expense to the taxpayers, as is, of course, the tremendous security requirements for Melania Trump to stay in Trump Tower in the middle of Manhattan. So Trump is a guy who understands that the politics of upstate is Trump land in many places. And as you get further up, it gets further Trump. And when Trump understands all of this, he plays to the upstate crowd and not to the New York City people, who frankly, at this stage of the game, have signs of despising their own president. So Trump is a guy who will understand intuitively, because he does, where he has to go in order to win the New York voters.
Trump rescinds protection for transgender students. I see in New York a statement from the Attorney General Eric Schneiderman that he will do whatever it takes to protect transgender and all LGBTQ New Yorkers.
David, this is just another good example of what the new federalism is going to look like. Obviously, you got a guy like Schneiderman who is emerging as the chief Trump resister in New York State because Andrew Cuomo, as we have said, has made some of the right sounds. But on the other hand, he's got to be careful because Trump, who's a take-no-prisoners kind of guy and a guy who remembers everything, might just take a good deal of Medicaid money and other things away from New York. So Schneiderman is up, and his brilliance as an attorney is being tested here, one of the world's biggest law firms. It certainly is one of the world's biggest public law firms. And New York State is going to have to step up because it ain't going to be the federal government with the likes of Trump and Paul Ryan and some of these other guys. So, you know, what'll happen is an awful lot of people will come to New York with they'll have protections that they don't have in other places, or to California or to Massachusetts. These are going to be the places that are the new United States of civil liberties. So good for Schneiderman. It's a great opportunity for him to show what he's got and to show that he's got some guts. Obviously, what happens is Trump looks at the poll results, and he looks at the people who elected him, and he says, well, what would they want me to do? And what they would want to do is do the kinds of things that progressives in this country hate, you know, start picking on people who have a different orientation than the majority do in some of these states, and Trump is doing it. It's really simply grotesque.
You mentioned New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman taking a role and being the chief fighter against the Trump administration policies. We also see New York Governor Andrew Cuomo this week promising to fight the rollback of affordable health care at a rally in the Bronx.
Well, look, Cuomo has a much more difficult row to hoe here. And that, frankly, David, is about the idea that, you know, he has to depend on Trump not to go after him as an enemy. If he does, if he makes that and he loses Medicaid money and he loses affordable health care money and a thousand other things that the president can do to the governor and to the state of New York, he could be in a bad spot. On the other hand, if he wants to be president, he has tack left, as they say in sailing, and he's been doing that.
I see an article here from The Observer that New York U.S. Senator Kirsten Gillibrand says Governor Andrew Cuomo would be a, quote, great candidate for Democrats to run against Trump in 2020. She told that to New York One. He's a great governor. He's done great things in our state. I love the fact that he's focused on paid leave and marriage equality. So he's a terrific governor, and I know he's running for re-election. It's what he has said as well.
Well, of course, this is to be expected, David. Kirsten Gillibrand has been mentioned herself many times for a spot on the next national ticket, perhaps as a vice presidential candidate. She is focusing on those things that she thinks are important. And Cuomo has gone there, perhaps to strengthen his left flank, which he's had some trouble with in the past, perhaps not. Doesn't much matter. She likes it if he fails. And if he's not the candidate, that would clear the way for her. So one can only suspect what the motives are here. But she's obviously being very smart in endorsing the chief executive of New York State, and it doesn't help to have him as an enemy, and it certainly helps to have him as a friend. So she's doing what she thinks is right. So far, the national polls show no appetite for Cuomo, but it's very early yet.
Finally, Alan, town halls, town meetings. We saw Congressman Paul Tonko, a Democrat, engage in a town meeting. The Times Union in Albany editorializing about Republicans, including Congressman John Faso and Elise Stefanik from New York, and not holding town meetings. And we see the president lashing out at these so-called angry crowds in home districts, saying they're liberal activists. This is sad.
Well, let's reject Trump for a moment. Let's put him aside. Let's talk about the wisdom of having town meetings. Look, Paul Tonko led the way. We interviewed him on the Congressional Corner yesterday. Look, much of his district went for Trump. And so, therefore, he knew, as people have known with the Tea Party in the past when they loaded town meetings and set the way for all of this happening. He knew what he faced, and yet he did it. I think it's clear that you can do it. If you can't, as a congressperson, aren't allowed to say your piece or to react to what a question is and a shut up, then you have a right to say, okay, I tried. But if you don't, and if you are rejecting town meetings, then what happens is you have people who properly say, you're avoiding us. That's the whole idea of constituency, and the House of Representatives is supposed to be closer to the people. I think it's important that we listen to each other. I think it's important we have those town meetings. But on the other hand, I think it's also important that the people who are at the town meetings are respectful.
Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Shartok. You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. New York's Eric Schneiderman and 10 other attorneys general have sent a letter to U.S. Senate leaders. The letter urges opposition to a bill that would eliminate states' authority to protect waterways from ships' polluted discharges, making it easier for non-native species to invade the Hudson River and Great Lakes. The Legislative Gazette's Allison Dunn explains.
Schneiderman says the legislation would stop states from taking actions they deem necessary to protect their waters from aquatic invasive species discharged by commercial ships. This occurs when ships dump ballast water. Dr. David Strayer is a freshwater ecologist with the Millbrook-based Cary Institute of Ecosystem Studies.
In my opinion, the Senate bill has the potential to cause further problems with regulations and open the door a little wider to the arrival of harmful species.
One example of an invasive non-native species already in New York waters is the zebra mussel, about which Strayer has written and studied extensively.
In the ecosystems where they occur, like the Hudson River or the Great Lakes, they're one of the dominant animals in the ecosystem. In the Hudson, they outweigh all other animals combined. And they cause great changes to the character of our ecosystem. So they affect, you know, water clarity and water chemistry and the populations of other plants and animals in the ecosystem. And then they also, of course, cause economic problems by fouling pipes and boat hulls and things like that.
Zebra mussels can clog the water intake pipes of power plants and municipal drinking water facilities. Schneiderman says the Hudson River is infested with more than 100 non-native species, and it was estimated in 2005 that the total environmental and economic impacts of biological pollution in the New York State Canal and Hudson River systems is nearly $500 million per year. John Lipscomb is patrol boat captain and vice president for advocacy for Riverkeeper.
If the federal government takes away our ability to set laws for commercial vessels and how they scrub their ballast water, we've taken away the rights of the people who live here and cherish this river.
He says the effects of zebra mussels in the Hudson are evident as they take over food sources other fish depend on.
That same bottom of the food chain is what herring eat, river herring, and what shad eat. So, you know, we've seen a decline in the size of herring over the past years when zebra mussel became established.
The Commercial Vessel Incidental Discharge Act also would exempt ballast discharges from the Federal Clean Water Act. Schneiderman says the bill relegates the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency to an advisory role and delegates primary responsibility for controlling these discharges to the U.S. Coast Guard. Again, Lipscomb.
We've often looked to the EPA as the knight in shining armor when the state's environmental protections and environmental laws were not adequate to protect the Hudson.
Strayer explains why he believes the attorneys general are concerned about states' authority being stripped in this arena.
I think you could argue that the federal government has been quite slow in regulating the movement of harmful species into the United States, in ballast water, through the pet and horticulture trades, through untreated wood, wood products, and so forth and so on. And so I think the states have really felt compelled to act in the absence of strong federal action to try to fill some of the gaps.
Schneiderman, a Democrat, says the Republican-sponsored bill that was introduced in January would provide a rubber stamp for shipping industry interest at the cost of the health of New York waters. There is no such bill in the House. Joining Attorney General Schneiderman's letter to the Senate leadership are the Attorneys General of Massachusetts, Vermont, California, Illinois, Maine, Michigan, Oregon, Rhode Island, and Washington.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Allison Dunn.
The Southern Poverty Law Center is out with an updated version of its hate map. As the Legislative Gazette's Dave Lucas reports, the group ranks New York State fourth in the nation for the number of active hate groups.
Marking what senior fellow Mark Potok attributes to a surge in right-wing populism, he writes, "The radical right was more successful in entering the political mainstream last year than in half a century." According to the SPLC, the number of what it classifies as hate groups operating in the U.S. in 2016 remained at near historic levels, rising from 892 in 2015 to 917.
I think that slight rise is probably not the most important information out of the report. I think what really is important is that that number, 917 hate groups, is just about 100 short of our all-time high of 1,018 hate groups, which is back in 2011.
The highest population states have the most.
California has 79 groups, Texas has 55, Florida has 63, and New York comes in fourth with 47.
Although it's sometimes unclear whether local people are actually affiliated with organized hate groups, some, like the Ku Klux Klan, have been active in the Hudson and Mohawk Valleys. Fort Plain police last week arrested someone for placing KKK recruitment flyers on car windshields. Others have been trying to instill fear by targeting Jewish community centers across the land. The Sidney Albert JCC in Albany has received two bomb threats in recent weeks. Adam Chaskin is the Albany JCC's executive director.
One of the great benefits, if that's an appropriate word, of the bomb threats here has been the outpouring of support that we've received from the community. Here at the JCC, we provide a place that is a safe place for everyone to come, no matter what their background or what their beliefs are, to come and interact.
So far in 2017, the JCC Association of North America says that there have been 69 incidents at 54 JCCs in 27 states and one Canadian province. Potok points out that by far the most dramatic change in the hate map was the enormous leap in anti-Muslim hate groups.
They, in fact, rose by 197%. In other words, they almost tripled from 34 groups in 2015 to 101 of these groups in 2016.
SPLC finds different kinds of hate groups in different parts of the country in different kinds of environments.
Black separatist hate groups are almost uniformly found in cities, most of them on the East Coast, some on the West Coast, but they are not a rural phenomenon at all. If, on the other hand, you look at Klan groups, they are universally rural. There are virtually none of them in cities.
The SPLC named 47 groups in New York where the upstate versus downstate scenario comes into play.
And it is in such situations that we often see real conflict, and typically the number of hate groups goes up in states like that. A similar thing is true of Florida. South Florida is very different. It is very worldly, very cosmopolitan, very Jewish, very black, very Latino, and that is not at all true of northern Florida, which is very white and very conservative. So that is part of the reason for the high count in Florida, and I think a similar thing is going on in New York.
In preparing its hate map and report, the SPLC used information furnished by the hate groups, along with police and media reports from around the country. You can read the full report and see the list of active hate groups posted at WAMC.org.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Dave Lucas.
Thank you.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. Heroin and opioid addiction is wreaking havoc across communities in New York, the Northeast, and the entire country. To that end, a frank discussion on heroin and opioid addiction was held in Washington County. The forum, moderated by District Attorney Tony Jordan, focused not only on the prevalence of opioid addiction in the Washington, Saratoga, and Warren County, New York regions, but also moving firsthand accounts. The Legislative Gazette's Lucas Willard was there.
The community forum Wednesday night in Hudson Falls was held directly after a Narcan training session. The drug is administered to reverse a heroin or opioid overdose. The Hometown versus Heroin Forum was moderated by Washington County District Attorney Tony Jordan.
This challenge knows no bounds. I mean, I think the statistics show and support that it is a suburban-rural epidemic.
Jordan said that in recent years, Washington County and the region have seen a rise in cases involving fentanyl, a synthetic opioid. He said the drug is often pressed into pills resembling prescription painkillers, but can be many times more potent and lethal. As law enforcement does its work, Jordan said it's important for individuals to know about the realities of the situation and keep an open dialogue about an epidemic that does not discriminate.
It's not going to get any better unless and until these discussions become mainstream and part of the public conscience everywhere.
Corrine Montani, a Lake George mother, told the story of her family's struggle with addiction. Montani lost her son to opioid addiction. She discussed how she had initially failed to recognize new behaviors in her son, like drinking and a change in friends, as an early sign of drug use.
I think the important thing is getting out there, talking to people that are going through it, not allowing yourself to get isolated, because then the only story you're hearing is the story your kids are telling you, and that's the story they want you to hear. So it doesn't allow you perhaps to take the actions that you should be taking.
Montani's daughter, Ashley Bellevue, also urged family members to have conversations about addiction, mental health issues, and thoughts of suicide. In addition to losing her brother, Bellevue's older sister also battled addiction. Bellevue said her family's experiences led her to find answers. She now works as an intake coordinator at Baywood Center, an addiction treatment center.
I had to find some way to try and deal with this addiction that was around me, and for me it was finding education and learning about it. And so learning about my personal experiences and then being able to identify that and help others, because no other family should have to go through what we've been through. And if I could prevent one more family member from not feeling my pain, then I'm going to.
The longest story of the night came from Ashley Livingston, a person in recovery. Now 29, Livingston elicited tears and applause from the audience as she described her graduation from painkillers to heroin, multiple stints in jail, detox, relapse, and recovery. She's been sober for 4 years and now works as a recovery advocate. Livingston explained why she shares her story as often as she can.
It's my experience, strength, and hope. So that's what I like to share. And the experience, you know, it can take a while because it doesn't. I also want people to know that just because somebody falls down doesn't mean they won't get back up and fight just as hard. Because I did, and I will continue to fight.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Lucas Willard.
And that about does it for this week's show. We had help from the New York State Public Radio Network. For copies, call 1-800-323-9262. That's 1-800-323-9262. Ask for program number 1708. Or just listen or podcast on the web at wamc.org. And join us again next week at this same time for more news on New York State government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Gustina.
Statewide distribution for the Legislative Gazette is made possible by New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.